Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, and I am your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. And my guest is Stephen Snyder, MD, a great psychiatrist and sex therapist, a rare combination, I must say. And Dr. Snyder is the author of Love Worth Making, How to Have Ridiculously Great Sex in a Long-Lasting Relationship. You will want to get this book. If I know many of you listening will be listening to the podcast rather than the live show, and I'll put links on how you can get this. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Snyder.
Thank you. Thank you, Diana. Really a pleasure. Enjoyed talking to you the first time. And can't wait to dig more into some of the things we talked about.
You're right. We've actually had two shows, and then Brian and I, my husband and I, were in New York, and we actually got to have a brief meal with you. It was great.
Yeah, it was fun. We just could get together at the end of the day after the office and all sorts of stuff. Yeah.
You work very long hours, I think, Steve.
Well, you know, my kids know that I'm a doctor, so I work hard, but they know I don't have to go into the hospital and I'm never on call, so that's good.
That's good, yes.
You know, with sex therapists, we don't have that many emergencies. You know, maybe an erection problem on a wedding night. But
yeah,
that's
right. So this is your third time on this show. I feel very privileged to have you on.
Thank you.
And you're welcome. And so I thought it would be useful, since you talk about these subjects in your book, Love Worth Making, if we talked about attachment and differentiation. And as a psychiatrist, I know you have, and you express them in the book, lots of thoughts about these two key concepts. You know, they're pretty key to who we are, the attachment and attachment theory and differentiation. And before we get into the meat of this, I wanted to read... Well, some of the listeners will know Dr. Jennifer Ashton. She's the ABC News Chief Women's Health Correspondent, and she has a really cute blurb on the back of your book cover. Love Worth Making does for sex therapy what Hamilton did for the Broadway musical. I can't wait to recommend it to my patients. And I bet she has sent you some people.
The thing that I tried to do in the book is to bring things alive in a different kind of way. You know, you see a lot of books that have little patient excerpts and stuff, but none of the patient excerpts really come alive. So I tried to spend a little more time with them and flesh out the characters in a little more detail. So, in general, they're characters that can stay with you, that you can remember who they are.
That's true. You have a wonderful way of integrating your case studies, and they illustrate your points so well. And it's lively.
Thank you.
My husband Brian wrote a review on Amazon. I tried to, but they rejected. They thought I knew you, which I do, but I don't know. They're getting more and more fussy, I guess.
Very curious. Very curious. Yeah.
Yeah.
What can you do?
So this is what Brian said. I borrowed Love Worth Making because you had sent me the book and I loaned him your book and found it to be an easy read, offering a jaunty mixture of client stories and the doctor's good advice. One of Stephen Snyder's key messages, which he sprinkles throughout the book in various guises, is to be with your partner and just slow down and notice what's going on or not going on. And this mindful approach can be very helpful in opening doors to creative solutions in a couple's sex life. So that was part of Brian's review, and I think it's good. The mindfulness part is... That's the way a lot of psychotherapists and psychiatrists are going these days, to be more mindful, and especially in sex therapy.
Yeah, as you know, this is what's called the third wave of practical, brief psychotherapies, where the first wave in the 1950s and so was the behavioral therapists,
Yeah.
And then the second wave was in the 90s with the cognitive therapists.
Yeah, and that's cognitive behavioral therapy,
which was a big advance in its day. Recently there's been an infusion of energy from the mindfulness people that says you don't want to just change your negative thoughts because that requires a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes what you want to do is you want to just accept them. Hey, yeah, I'm thinking really negatively. Let's see what happens next, and maybe not get all emotional about the fact that I'm having negative thoughts. That's extremely important during sex because you can't really just tell your partner, look, let me just kind of do a little cognitive worksheet and look at my negative thoughts right
yeah,
here in bed.
Right.
But you can use the third wave method, which is to say, could you just hold me here because I'm just having this burst of self-attacking feelings, and I think I just need to kind of wait until they pass and not get too emotional about them. And the other person says, oh, yeah, sure, yeah. Thanks for telling me what was going on. I thought you were going to tell me you were going to break up with me or something. You know, they're often relieved
yeah.
about what's going on.
Yeah, so. Lots of partners appreciate it when their
Absolutely.
Partner can be so vulnerable and communicative and say
yeah,
what's going on.
And say what's going on and what's not going on. You know,
and what's not
person,
going on.
Some person can just say, you know, I just am so distracted or, you know,
mm-hmm.
so concerned. I just can't seem to relax right now. And you say, oh, that's fine. You know, I'm just glad you told me what's going on. I thought you were going to try and break up with me.
often started with, we need to talk.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, watch out for that one.
Right.
So you mentioned you wanted to talk about
yes.
Attachment.
And you start that discussion in your book with talking about Murray Bowen. And I remember I first got my master's before my PhD, and I do remember Murray Bowen was a big part of our education.
Yeah, but he was a wild thing. I mean, I don't know how
yeah.
much history of psychology your viewers, by and large, have, but let me just assume that they don't have this particular background. He back in the day, he got federal research money
mm-hmm.
to spend years at the National Institute of Mental Health observing the families of acutely decompensated mental patients.
Mm-hmm.
And the person would be admitted to the hospital with schizophrenia or mania or depression or whatever
mm-hmm.
it was,
mm-hmm.
and they would admit the person's entire family. And so the
mm-hmm.
entire family would live on the ward, and Bowen's team would record all their interactions. And they discovered some amazing things. They discovered there were really just two extremes of kinds of families. In the one kind of family, which they called the poorly differentiated family, everybody just kind of reacted to everybody else.
Yeah.
And everybody went around in a state of high anxiety, and people didn't really have the ability to calm themselves down.
Mm-hmm.
And in the other extreme, somebody could be, you know, going nuts or something, and the other person would say, well, you know, just like come back when you feel a little bit better. You're not, you know, you didn't have to react so much. And so
yeah.
these families were called better differentiated.
Yes.
And it was just like they had better shock absorbers, and the people were
oh, that's a good analogy. Shock,
yeah.
okay.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and they just better ability to calm themselves down and soothe themselves rather than just react to what the other person was saying. So they were just buffered a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
And it used to be thought that this intense emotionality actually caused schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm.
And then it became clear that it did not cause schizophrenia. But they later it's been shown that this intense emotionality tends to precipitate breakdowns in people who are prone to schizophrenia. It also precipitates relapses in people with just about every kind of mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
we know that basically most kinds of mental illness can be helped if the family situation can just buffer it rather than just react to it. So the person who really brought this into couples work was Harriet Lerner in the Dance of Anger.
Dance of Anger, which you describe in your book, too.
Yeah, which is 1985, and it sold something like 3 million copies, which is
yes.
viable. So really, and, you know, her famous quotation was that you can't make another person change their steps to an old dance, but you can change your own steps, and if you do that, the dance can no longer continue in the same predictable pattern. So the idea, again, kind of following on Bowen's work, that you could just, if you could calm yourself down
mm-hmm.
and not just react to something the other person was doing, then you can really get much more creative. And then the person who finally brought this into the sexual sphere was David Schnarch in Colorado. He was in Louisiana, then Colorado, who said, you know, a lot of couples get into this thing where they're just reacting to each other and they're expecting each other to validate each other and support each other emotionally, which you would think is what couplehood is all about from reading Hallmark cards, but it's really not. It's really much more about calming yourself down so that you're not just reacting, but you're really in a more thoughtful way responding to what the other person says. And the couples' relationships work better when each person is taking care of their own, their own mental health needs, rather than relying on each other, which again goes completely against everything that you see on the Hallmark cards. But it's really the truth. And a lot of times, I'm sure you see this when you see a couple who's in distress for one reason or another. It's because they're not too far apart, but they're just too close. You know, as Schnarch says, they're kind of sharing a circulatory system.
Yes.
And they're like Siamese twins. They're constantly transfusing each other with anxiety. And what
that's
they really
right.
need, they need to separate a little bit. And hence the idea of differentiation, which Schnarch got from Murray Bowen.
Yes, he did. One of the exercises that I give to my couples is from David Schnarch's book, Intimacy and Desire, and it's Hugging Till Relaxed.
Uh-huh.
So you hug for about 4 minutes with your partner, stand on your own 2 feet, put your arms around your partner, focus on yourself, quiet yourself down, way down.
Right.
Because, you know, he's as you've already touched on, he says that the ability to quiet and calm yourself down without having to pull away from your partner is important. So you can quiet yourself when your partner might be flooded with anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And and I think that's why he also says, you don't work on your marriage. Your marriage works on you. It's a people growing system, is what he says.
Well,
and
what
I that's Paul true.
Him saying is that people usually start off in marriage with the Hallmark idea.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to just kind of infuse each other with such wonderful energy that everything is going to be okay. But then ultimately the well runs dry, and you have to kind of learn to infuse yourself. Which is, and people always say, well, isn't that unromantic? And you say, no, it's much more romantic if you do it right.
And that's why David Schnarch says that better sex is more available to you as if you're maybe, say, past 50, because you're very likely to be more differentiated by then.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And let's give the listeners a definition. Differentiation involves learning to balance your individuality, that is your separateness, with your emotional connection to someone else, your togetherness.
Yeah.
And that's really hard for a lot of young people because going back some years, I remember a young person saying, newly engaged, oh, we're just like two hearts beating as one. It's so exciting.
I know, you always hear that, and I go, oh,
yeah.
No.
Let there be some spaces in your togetherness and do your own work. But that often doesn't happen until somebody's a little bit more mature.
Yes.
And has gotten past, I love your Hallmark analogy, gotten past the Hallmark card.
Exactly.
The romance.
Exactly, because if you put a more differentiated notion of love on a Hallmark card, people would say that sounds odd.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my favorite version of this was Fritz Perls. Back in the 60s, where he says, I'm not in this world to live up to your expectations, and you're not in this world to live up to mine. You know, I'll do my thing, you do yours, and if by chance we meet, it's beautiful, and if not, it can't be helped.
I like that a lot.
Yeah, it's pretty raw. It's pretty
uh-huh.
raw. I think it's a better foundational place to start from.
I agree very much. David Schnarch, with his first book, and you point this out in your book, that, let's see, where is it? Well, it's the 600 And I remember, 1991, Constructing the Sexual Crucible. I remember reading this when I was a much younger person because it wasn't about 1991. And, you have to be really dedicated to get through that book. And then Dr.
Not many people, but even back then, could read a book that was 600 pages long. And
very theoretical.
And now, forget it. You know, unless it's, it's 2 minutes of a YouTube video, it's very hard to get people's attention.
Oh, that's right. Our attention spans have been limited a lot.
So that's one of the reasons I wrote my book, was to say, okay, well, let's locate this these practices within their context. Certainly the original research by Bowen, and then Lerner's work and Schnarch's work, and then how do we really see this playing out with real couples? And I use a somewhat different phrasing for it. I say the phrase is standing your ground. You really want to make sure that when you're with
title
your partner,
of your chapter.
Yeah, that when you're with your partner,
11,
with
right?
Your partner, you're really this chapter 12, standing
12.
Down,
I mean, yeah,
you're really advocating for your own needs, because this is contrary to what most people hear. Most people hear that in a relationship you're there to take care of your partner's needs, and you should give your partner this and give your partner that. And I always think of the old O. Henry story, The Gift of the Magi.
Oh, yes.
Repeat that for our listeners. This woman, they have no money, a young couple. She sells her hair, which is her most precious thing to her in the world, to buy an accessory for her husband's watch, which is the most precious thing to him in the world. And he sells his watch to buy her some combs for her hair. It's like what most couples do. They give away the store there, and in the process, they give away what's most precious to themselves, and they end up very, very unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
It's far better to say, okay, I'm going to keep what's precious about me. You keep what's precious about you. And when we're together, I'm going to tell you what I really want to need, and you'll tell me what you want to need. And very often they'll be in conflict, which is really, really hard and really painful. But if you stay with the conflict, then creative things happen. If you're able to suffer together honestly in the conflict, then creative things happen. I wrote an article once called Dining and Differentiation.
Oh.
Talk about a couple who, if you Google dining and differentiation, it's Stephen Snyder, MD, you get the article. And
I will, and I want our listeners to Google it too.
I love
the title, Dining and Differentiation. Now tell me about it.
It's about a couple who can't decide where to go out to eat because they hate each other's choice of restaurants.
Uh-huh.
And
okay.
So you have some choices at that point. One person could say, oh, well, I don't care. I'll just go out to this person's choice of restaurants even though I don't like it. Well, that'll be okay once in a while. That's the generosity idea. Well, the other thing is you could say, I'm going to force the other person to go to my restaurant because they never do what I want. And that doesn't work at all.
That's a little bit of a power play. They don't do what I'm going to exert my influence here.
Yeah, and then the third thing you could do is just break up and say there's no hope for us as a couple because we have too many differences. Problem is that in some way, large or small, this kind of thing happens to every couple sooner or later. Sooner or later you come to some, because nobody is completely compatible in all ways. And at some point where you're going to come to it where you realize you absolutely just disagree and there is no easy resolution. In this story, the couple decides to go hunt around for restaurants for a third kind of restaurant that neither of them have ever been to before.
Oh, that's like a compromise.
And that's a compromise, and that becomes their restaurant.
Oh, good.
Because it's something that they discovered together as a couple that they never would have discovered if they hadn't been a couple. And that's the key.
Yeah.
What I say else later in the book is there's three stages of most human endeavors. The first is the stage of inspiration, which is extremely important. The second is the stage of disappointment, which is inevitable. And the third is the stage of creative mastery.
And
I took this from personal experience. My wife and I had been dating for about 8 months, and we're trying to figure out whether we're going to get married or not.
Yeah.
And it was extremely disappointing because I discovered that she had terrible taste in furniture. Could not stand.
I remember you're talking a little
and
bit.
And she discovered that I had terrible taste in furniture. She could
you
stand.
Just were not aligned in that
and
area.
we just thought each other's taste was horrendous. And we decided that if in all of New York we could find a couch that we could agree on, we'd get married.
Well, you must.
And we really wanted to get married, but we were just so frightened that we're going to be with this person who's just going to have this awful taste. We're just going to have awful decor our entire life. And, every relationship comes to this point where the person says to themselves, I'm in a relationship with who? This is the worst possible person in the world for me to be in a relationship, which, of course, is not true. And so and there was a point where we were sitting very, very weary one day, having been looking for couches all over the city for days and couldn't find anything we agreed on. And finally we went down to the basement of this store, and there was this really funky couch that was kind of an outdoor couch. And there was Ella Fitzgerald was playing a Cole Porter songbook, and we just sat there exhausted, and it started to rain, and we're sitting on this funky old couch, and it became our favorite album, Ella Fitzgerald with the Cole Porter songbook, and we never got that couch because it really wouldn't fit. We ended up getting a couch that neither of us liked really very much, and we replaced it after a while, after both of our kids had vomited on it many, many times. But it was important at the time. And now we've been married 27 years, and we have identical tastes. So whatever.
Oh, see what happens.
You see what happens. Yeah,
and I bet you also still like Ella Fitzgerald.
You never would have gotten there if you'd been with somebody else. So.
That's right. But don't you still like Ella Fitzgerald's song? Wasn't that part of the bonding experience?
That's our thing, because it represented our pain and suffering together. You know.
Uh huh.
You have to suffer together. You know.
Yeah.
In order to really do it right.
And then the understanding that indeed you can get through this together,
yeah,
the trust that you can get through it together.
And I really one of the things that I hammer on a lot in the book, especially in the last part of the book, has to do with faith. People say, "Well, faith, that's just for religious people." It's not really. Faith is just this kind of internal sense that things are going to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
When you take steps as a couple to extend yourselves a little bit in terms of taking on situations that are kind of difficult, and then you do them together, that builds your faith as a couple, and you really need that when you find a couch that you both agree on, that kind of builds your faith, even if you both kind of hate it a little bit, and that you actually did it. And that's extremely important. And that sense of faith is very important for sexuality, principally because in almost every sexual relationship over time, your sense of lust for each other diminishes. And if you don't have that sense of faith that it's going to be okay, there's a tendency to freak out. And when you freak out, that's not so erotic. And so a lot
Hardly.
Of couples,
yeah.
they freak out, and the other person freaks out, and they start, like those Murray Bowen poorly differentiating couples, they start to ping, ping, ping back at each other, and make each other more and more anxious.
And more anxious, yes. And that's what Bowen discovered.
Yeah, exactly. The erotic relationship goes to hell.
Mm-hmm.
So it's up to usually one person to quiet themselves down and say, "No, wait a minute, come here, just hold me for a minute. Let's see if I can calm myself down a little bit."
Yeah, if we can circle back maybe a little bit here and there to attachment and attachment theory, if somebody is an anxious type, emerged as an anxious person from attachment, that person needs a lot of attention, and the more avoidant person needs a lot of space. So these are relationship roadblocks when the anxious person is with an avoidant, and again, it's communication that is important. In my experience, and I use attachment theory, I think it's the best lens for viewing adult love and relationships, that attachment theory states that our our primary motivation in life is to be connected with other people. And we get all, if we feel our partner is distancing from us, it's all about emotional distance. And that's part of it. But anyway, a couple more things. The anxious person, anxious attachment style, they crave intimacy and closeness. They tend to love being coupled up, but they consider relationships fragile, and they're sensitive to even minor shifts in their partner's mood. Mm-hmm. So,
now, I'm sure a lot of people in the audience could identify that that's who they are.
So these folks may have a harder time telling someone what they want.
Absolutely.
And they're more likely to mope or withdraw or even to lash out.
Yeah.
They didn't have the secure attachment as a kid. And, and the avoidant person likes to do things on his or her own and enjoys calling the shots and may worry about being committed to someone will mean a loss of independence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
absolutely. So we've got all of those things, and then we can talk about the securely attached person. I don't know how I got so lucky, but I did grow up in a family that was loving and affectionate, and so I got secure attachment, and it's made a big difference.
Yeah,
even keeled and emotionally available, as most secure attached people are.
Yeah, I wonder though how many people in your radio or podcast audience are familiar with the background there of those three terms.
We could talk about that. You talk first, and then I'll fill in because I like attachment theory. It makes a lot of sense. Dr. Schneider.
Comes from a series of experiments that were done in the 1960s, which, when you read about them, they're a little grotesque. What they would do is they would take a mother and a child, 1 or 2 years old child. And the mother would be sitting with the child, just having a good time, hanging out. And then the mother would leave the room, which is, a primal distress situation for the child. Mm-hmm. And then after a minute or two, the mother would come back, and they would watch what the child does. And some kids, which they labeled securely attached, would say, oh, okay, well, it was a disruption. Now mom's back, and we'll just go back to playing normally. Other kids that they labeled anxiously attached would just clutch on to mom and not let her go and look very, very stressed. So they just couldn't quiet themselves down as much. They still felt that this danger had not yet passed.
And let me just interrupt you because I think the key point there is that these children are so preoccupied with their caregiver's availability that they never get to explore the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the downside of being insecurely attached.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third group, which was kind of a surprise, nobody had really predicted the existence of this third group, were kids who, when mom came back, they looked normal.
Mm-hmm.
They looked like the secure attached kids. But if you looked very closely at the videotapes, they were showing signs of severe stress.
Mm-hmm.
And they were either gritting their teeth or just appeared tense. And the speculation was that these kids had experienced a lot of stress and were not necessarily letting it out or expressing it. But what they had done is that they had taken over some of their own needs, as if they were saying, you leave me, I'm not going to rely on you again.
Right.
I'm now my own person. I'm going to take care of my own needs.
Mm-hmm.
And where this comes in with couples in adults, and it's obviously a lot of speculation involved with going from these infantile experiments to adult life, but mm-hmm. there are people who do seem to fundamentally trust just themselves in terms of take care of themselves.
That's right.
And other people who are insecure, who just fundamentally trust just being taken care of by somebody else. And then other people who just seem to harmoniously kind of put the two together, the secure people.
What I think of
in terms of relationships is that it's important if you choose a partner that you choose somebody who's compatible with you. And
I think of it
like blood types.
People with
secure attachments, or secure enough attachments, I mean, these things are not black and white. People with secure attachment who can be relatively flexible in terms of somewhat taking care of their own needs and relying on others without being too anxious about it. Those people are like the O blood type. They're the universal donor.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody can have a relationship with somebody who's securely attached. The others are the ones who are just not universal donors. If you're really highly avoidantly attached, you need somebody who's pretty securely attached to kind of buffer you a little bit, because on your own you have a hard time doing that. And if you're somebody who's anxiously attached, you need somebody who's pretty securely attached to do that. The mistake that people make is when they cross too far over to the other side. Somebody who's an anxiously attached person will go after somebody who's an avoidantly attached person, and that's usually poison. It's usually poison. So in general, you don't want to do that. And the other thing is that most people contain different combinations of these things.
Right.
Give you a personal example.
Yes.
I also grew up in a relatively secure house. Things were pretty even keeled and not a lot of emotional disruptions. But when I was very young, which through things I won't get into, there were a couple of times where I really was left on my own and nobody could really do anything about it. And as a result, you know, there's a lot of me that's securely attached, but there's also a good part of me that's avoidantly attached. And that says, you know, I think I'm going to just take care of myself here, and doesn't rely on other people the same way as somebody who's purely securely attached. You see this with a lot of writers. A lot of writers are avoidantly attached because when they're writing, when they're thinking about their writing, they're communing essentially with themselves. They might call it their muse or their inspiration, but it's a force or a power within themselves. And that's what they trust the most. They trust that feeling of contact with something deep in themselves, rather than necessarily seeking it out from somebody, some person in the real world.
That's fascinating, Dr. Snyder. That is, I'm so glad you used a personal example.
Well, one that I know well, very well.
So, yes, of course.
Yeah.
And it makes a lot of sense. I also suggest to my clients that if a secure person is with an anxious one, that it's important to be receptive to his or her desire for security.
Yeah.
And allay fears when, I don't know, second guessing or smothering seems to be going on.
Yeah.
And if the secure person is with an avoidant who's clamming up, talk about how you can give him or her the space that they might not even realize they want.
Yeah, I mean, my wife knows that I have to just sometimes go off for several hours and just think and write, and just without that, really not going to be.
So that's also the more introverted part of you.
Well, you know, all these are just labels.
Sure, I know.
So you know, 20 years from now, we'll have everybody's DNA sequences mapped out, and we'll show how everybody's, epigenetics have moved on that, and we'll have the whole thing worked out. For now, we just have these kind of crude labels, but I think they are useful. I agree with you there.
Yes. You, in your book, under the resources, you have Dr. Stella Resnick's book, her most recent book. But her first book she's a friend, many years a friend, and a colleague.
I did not know that.
Yes, and
yeah,
so
I've never met her. We have friends in common, but I've never met her.
Yeah, she's a fabulous woman, and she lives in Los Angeles. And recently, Brian and I had dinner with Stella and Alan. And so her first book was The Pleasure Zone, Why We Resist Good Feelings and How to Let Go and Be Happy. And I like that book even more than her second book, although the second book is good. She's a great writer, like you are, and very insightful. But she talks about, she uses attachment theory a lot, and she talks about how she grew up in a family in Brooklyn where she had a combination of anxious avoidant attachment, where her stepfather beat her regularly and her mother was distant, emotionally distant and not available to her. And so she went through a number of relationships and even a couple of marriages before she met Alan. She's still married to Alan. She talks about this in her book. I'm not revealing any new information.
Yeah.
But they've been married for over 30 years. They are a fabulous couple. They're so smart and so kind and all of that. So Alan grew up in a family that was secure attachment. He grew up... Stella grew up a Jew and was head of the gang in Brooklyn, the girls' gang. And Alan grew up in Pasadena and was a Presbyterian and came out of this rather wealthy family, but you know, was secure. So her point is that since she had anxious avoidant attachment, that she got earned over the years, earned secure attachment by being in relationship with Alan. And I think that that is possible.
I think so, too. I mean, my wife is securely attached. She's one of these O-type universal donor kind of people.
And, yeah.
So she just kind of held on to me long enough that I could trust her. Yeah. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you must be great parents.
Yeah, we do our best.
Because you're both intelligent and you're both psychologically sophisticated and aware. And
yeah, I don't know if you want to tell our radio audience the fact that my wife also can't talk. Did I mention that? Did I mention that to you?
No.
No, she's a stroke survivor. I can't believe it. I must have mentioned.
Oh, I didn't know that. She can't talk.
Yeah, she can't talk. Yeah, yeah.
How long has that been going on?
27 years. Yeah. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Do you sign language with each other?
No. We use the most ancient of languages. You know, human language is only 40,000 years old. It's relatively early.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's relatively late in human evolution. That's why one of the last things that kids learn to do is talk. It doesn't happen until age 2.
That's right.
You know, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, and, you know, it's a very recent acquisition in our species.
Mm.
And you know, chimpanzees and stuff—they can't talk, but they can get the message across just fine. You know, when one of them is fond of you, and you know, one of them is angry at you. And
talk about chimpanzees, I want to talk about bonobos.
Yeah, chimpanzees.
They make love, not war.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
They solve all their conflict with sex.
Yeah, I'm a little doubtful about that. You know, what we know about bonobos is they're in captivity. And they're often very, very traumatized bonobos. You know, those are the ones who lost their parents to the bushmeat trade and stuff like that. But certainly they do a lot more negotiating with sex than they do with other things. But anyhow, to get back to any animal. And so, you know, you're married. You know, how many discussions do you have? You maybe have 8 to choose from. You know, my wife will raise her eyebrows. I know what she's talking about. I say, no, we're not going to do that. You know, so, and she goes, yes, we are. You know, so we could have a whole argument. We don't really need a lot of talking. So
that is fascinating, Steve.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah. She had a stroke.
And how does that affect your children?
I don't know. We've never known any other way. She had a stroke about 27 years ago, but 10 weeks after we got married.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm embarrassed to say I'm a marriage and sex therapist. I've never been married normally, you know, but I've learned a lot from the experience.
No, you can learn.
Yeah, you learn a lot from the experience.
If
absolutely.
You keep your eyes open,
wherever
there are difficulties, failures, end quote, if you keep your eyes open, you can learn and improve.
There's a famous story. It's actually from, I think it's from the Downs syndrome literature.
Uh-huh.
So it's a bit of a stretch, but it says, you know, something like this happens. It's a little bit like you were planning a trip to Italy, and all of a sudden they rerouted the plane, and the plane goes to Holland. And you go, wait a minute, Holland? I didn't want to go to Holland. I was going to go to Italy. And you go, well, you know what? Holland's kind of an interesting country. So you know, things go the way that you didn't. You know, you didn't quite plan them. But because I'm a little bit have an avoidance streak, it actually helped me. because I was very self-sufficient. I didn't really need a lot.
Right.
And so I was able to manage for years and years, you know, during the early years after this happened. And you know, she was always there, and we worked it out.
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I'm thinking...
She popped out two kids, too. You know,
I know. And they're, I suspect they're just great kids. You've got one in college and one about to go?
One's about to go, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're about to clean house. Yeah, we're very excited.
Yeah. And ideally, the empty nest should become even the more love nest, right?
Can't wait.
Can't wait. Good.
You know, because as a guy especially, you know, because women, they tend to have that, I mean, I don't want to make any total awful gender generalization, but, you know, that umbilical cord never really gets cut for a lot of women. And so, you know, as a guy, you know, your youngest child goes off to college, and
mm-hmm.
you know, it's the first time in years and years that you've had your wife's complete attention.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking forward to that.
Well, yes, I work, as I know you do, with lots of couples who've been married a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the origins of your book.
As a matter of fact, the idea of how to keep an erotic relationship going on for a long, long time.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so it's one of the things that's hard for a lot of, and you mentioned this at some point in your book about the difficulties with raw emotion, intimacy, intimacy. Mm-hmm. And Erica Jong, I really like her. You probably are somewhat familiar with her books.
Of course.
Yes.
Yeah.
Starting in 1973, Fear of Flying. And I've read so many of her books. But so here's from her. She says that shared goals keep couples together. If this were not true, how would some couples survive illnesses, deaths of beloved family members, even Holocausts?
Mm-hmm.
The pair bond is strong. We are pair-bonded creatures, like swans or geese. We can also be as promiscuous as baboons or bonobos.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the two extremes of human sexuality.
Is this Erica Jong? You're...
Yes, I am.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And so she says there are various gradations of chastity and sensuality in between. Now, here's the important part. The glue that holds couples together consists of many things: laughter, companionship, tenderness, and sex. The busyness of marriage is real, but we also use it to protect us from raw intimacy, from having to be too open too much of the time. Pleasure is terrifying, because it breaks down the boundaries between people.
Hmm.
Embracing passion means living with fear. And now the final thing I want to say, she quotes poet Rupert Brooke. And when I read this, I didn't know who he was. I looked him up, Google. He was this really handsome guy who was killed at a young age in World War I. But he was a poet. Listen to this quote from him. Love is the breach in the walls, a broken gate. Love sells the proud heart, citadel, to fate. And she adds, Erica Jong adds, amen.
Okay.
That raw intimacy thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard for a lot of people to be that vulnerable, to be that open.
Well, you know, one of the things that I talk about in my book, frankly, close to the beginning, because I just felt if nobody reads past the beginning, at least they would get that part, is that so many of the emotions that we experience as adults in intimate relationships seem to be a reawakening of emotions from earliest childhood.
Mm.
States of pure pleasure, states of fusion of physical intimacy with emotional intimacy. Because, you know, originally there's really no difference between sensation and emotion for a kid. All emotions are just kind of like based on sensations and feeling good and feeling bad and who really knows exactly what's going on, and self and other and who really knows what's going on. And it can be terrifying for people to go back there, to be drawn back into that vortex of intense emotion. I think it's absolutely right.
At the same time, you like Avadhyaya Offutt, and you quote her, and she talks, and you quote her in your book.
Yeah.
And she talks about.
I don't know how many people in your audience know Avadhyaya Offutt. I mean, she was well known back in the 70s.
In the 70s and 80s, and I still have her two
virtually
books.
Virtually forgotten these days.
Too bad, because her first book, Sexual Self, and then. The next book,
Night Thoughts. Thoughts of a Sex Therapist.
Fascinating, and I have both of her books in my library.
One of the reasons I wrote my book is I thought to myself, you know, somebody should take all the juiciest quotes from Avadhyaya Offutt from the 1970s and weave them into a book. I want to do that. I want to do that. So I took all my favorite, juiciest Avadhyaya Offutt quotes she was very funny, which was one of the best things about her. I'm looking here, there's one quote. If it's okay, if I read.
Oh, please!
From chapter 12.
Please do.
Chapter 12 in my book, Standing Your Ground. She writes, Avadhyaya Offutt, who was a sex therapist in New York City back in the day. She writes, sometimes a man requires help in being actively assertive. He needs to do as he pleases with his partner, or to tell her what to do. The requests he may learn to make are occasionally as simple as, please move your elbow, it's in my ribs.
Yeah, right. As simple as that.
It gives you a flavor. You know, she originally set out to be a writer and then decided she had to make a living. She had to be a doctor. But she kind of never gave up the writerly part of her. And one of the
I think they're quite wonderful books. You point out in your book that the first book, Sexual Self, is in some ways a little outdated.
It's a little
not
dated,
so
yeah.
much Night Thoughts.
No, Night Thoughts is a little more contemporary. Yeah.
Yeah.
But
and she talks about the child experiencing his or her first forms of ecstasy by being at the mother's breast.
Absolutely. You know, she was steeped in attachment theory because, you know, when she was training and writing in the late 60s and early 70s, attachment theory and these experiments that we were talking about, these had just come out. I mean, these were like the latest thing.
Right,
Everybody was talking about this. It
kind
of set the world on fire. So she was in the first lush of people thinking about these things. And the other thing which is about her, which is she was, you know, primarily a writer as opposed to some of her contemporaries who were more scientifically oriented. She was never really much of a scientist. And that was really the inspiration for my book because although I went to medical school and, you know, studied science and still have to stay abreast of it, it's not really where my heart is. I always felt that people in writing sex books, they make too much of science. You know, they want to do the latest study or this or that or this sample of how many women and how many men did this. And, you know, you can pile study on top of study on top of study and never really get to the heart of what sex really means for people. And so for me, I thought to myself, you have to approach it through some different way. And you have to approach it really through character, through emotion. And we're not yet at the point where we can do science on those things.
Book is so unique and wonderful, and it has resonated.
I was glad that you liked it because, you know, you write such a thing in isolation. You don't know if anybody's gonna like it or hear it. Most sex books that are written these days are, okay, here's what science tells you about sex. And that seems to be kind of the currency of the realm. And so I wanted to write a contrarian book, which goes in a completely different direction. It says, throw out all the science. What do you observe within yourself when you're having the best sex? What's it feel like? And so I sat for a long time with lots of couples saying, okay, now just tell me exactly what this feels like. And they would say things like, I felt like I didn't really care what else happened in the world. Somebody was calling, and I didn't care who it was. I just wanted them to go away. I felt a sense of, yeah, this is me. This is the meanness of me. This is where I really live. And I, you know, feel very close to my partner. I don't really want to hear all about their day. You know, I feel kind of selfish. And it was that primal selfishness that I decided was very close to the core of what most people mean when they say good sex, which, again, flies completely against what you see in the Hallmark cards, where it has to do with pleasuring, you know, your partner, giving to your partner. No, and it's really taking. Taking is much more erotic than giving.
Yes. Well, you... Taking is more erotic than giving, yes.
Absolutely. I mean, if most people, if you could imagine one of two possible hypothetical partners, one of whom is like a geisha, you know, and just wants to give you everything, and the other just wants to take hungrily from you because they just are so passionate about you. You know, most people will take the one that wants to take. It's just more erotic.
It's more erotic. And for women with sexual dysfunctional problems like lack of orgasm, there are lots of sort of they feel that their partner, the woman who's anorgasmic, feels that her partner may have expectations.
Absolutely.
Can't really be in her body. So the body awareness stuff is so important, the mindfulness, right? And the letting go, and she can't really do that unless she is a bit selfish and in her body.
Not only that, but I would say she can't do it if she's aware that she has a lover who desperately wants to give her an orgasm.
Oh, yeah, that's
thinking,
such a male myth. I'm going to give this woman an orgasm.
Exactly, and you see this in all the books, how to give your partner an orgasm, and I go, oh, my God, that sounds so boring. Now, a lot of people disagree with me. A lot of people say, no, it's a great thing to give your partner. What do you want to be selfish? And I go, yes, absolutely. Cheryl Cohen Green, you know, who was the sex surrogate that the movie The Sessions was based on.
Right, exactly.
I interviewed her a while ago, and she's just talking about her first husband. And I said, well, what's so good about him? Because he was a troublesome man in a lot of ways. She said, well, during sex, he was completely selfish. He was just involved in his own pleasure. And I said, did that make you feel left out? She goes, no, it was liberating. Because he was so completely involved in his own pleasure that I could be completely involved in mine. I didn't have to worry about responding to whatever he wanted to do, because whatever he was going to do was just for him. And it was that sense of utter selfishness that led her to be able to do the same thing and to be able to really let go with him. You see, a lot of women who fantasize about that. I have women, I talk about some of them in the book, who fantasize about being with a partner who just doesn't care about them at all and is just involved in his own pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And in fantasy, I mean, obviously in reality, it might be a little lonely with some partners who were like this. A partner might really just not care enough to make sure that they were satisfied. That's not what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody who can really regress back to a point where they really want to take with a pure heart. Now, that's something really, really special. And, you know, I always say in romance novels, no hero in a romance novel ever rips the woman's clothes off and then says, now tell me how you want to be touched. You know, instead he just consumes her, you know, so the fantasy of being consumed by somebody who's not really worried about you at all. Or as Michael Bader, who's another writer who writes very eloquently on this, said, he says, the ability to be fairly ruthless and to use your partner ruthlessly for your pleasure. Now, most of us with the right partner might kind of enjoy that.
Mm-hmm. Don't you think that may be one reason why, let's see, who's the author of My Secret Garden from the early 70s?
Nancy Friday.
Yes, Nancy Friday. And she said in that book that a very common fantasy for women was to be raped. Not that they wanted to be raped in real life.
Of course not, no.
Who wants that? But
to be able,
the
to
idea
be able to
of being... Well, I mean, rape is not about desire, but they could, in the fantasy, they could say that this man wanted them so much.
In the fantasy, it is, and also that for some
And they don't have to take responsibility for their own sexuality. Right. They're just
also for
taken.
Somebody to have for somebody to have that much power, because I mean, power is sexy. And for somebody to have that kind of ultimate power, and I hear a lot of women saying, I just want to surrender to somebody who has that much power and who can take that much power for himself. So I don't think as the male species we've kind of gotten there yet. That's why so many women read romance novels, I think, because
they haven't
learned quite how to put that together. You know, you have the, I always say male man 1.0 who, you know, was really oblivious. That's not what most women want. And then there's male 2.0, which is kind of where we are now, which is the man who just, he's read all the books and he knows all the techniques and he wants to give them the orgasm and wants to make them happy with him, and that's not really doing it either. We're really looking for man 3.0, where he's not oblivious. He's more passionately selfish, but there's a kind of a selfish connection. I think if I were to put it into a phrase, it'd be selfish connection. You want to be selfishly connected to each other. Little bit, you know, in a way, although it's a stretch, a little bit like a nursing infant or a mother and a baby. There's a selfish connection. Mother is not trying to give the baby a pleasant experience. Mother's just enjoying the baby. And the same thing with the baby. The baby's not trying to give the mother a pleasant experience. The mother's pleasant. Baby's just enjoying the mother. Each of them is selfishly enjoying the other, and yet the whole thing works. And that's really where you want to go, I think, for the best sex.
Because
one man's opinion. Not everybody agrees with me, but that's one man's opinion.
No, I think it's true, and because I breastfed both my kids for actually a year, and you're kind of just in flow, and it feels good,
and you don't give a damn about the rest of the world.
Bonding with the baby, and the baby's bonding with you, and it's just a nice experience.
And you're just letting yourself, you know, kind of get carried along in the current.
Yes.
Do anything. Your body just takes over.
That's
and your body's
right.
just doing what a body does. And that's like almost the definition of good sex.
Oh, it is indeed. And that's perhaps a good place to leave this. So I'm going to let people know when I write this up. It'll be archived by tomorrow morning.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, this is really fun that we've had a chance to kind of explore all the nooks and crannies of this thing.
I hope I can convince you to come back, you know, maybe the end of the summer if you're around.
Be happy to find more nooks and crannies to explore.
Okay, great.
All right, thank you,
Diana.
Snyder.
Thank
right,
you.
Take care. All right,
goodbye, everybody. Labirinto di un amaro auto.